I find this scientifically fascinating.
You're listening to KUCI Irvine.
Disengage this computer now.
Broadcasting at 88.9 FM.
Hello, computer.
And on the web at kuci.org.
The most reliable computer ever made.
And streaming through iTunes.
Don't expect any mercy during the Great Robot Wars.
Anteater Radio brought to you by machines. Returning to normal broadcast in 3, 2, 1.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Good morning and welcome to this August 22nd, 2012 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. We are always available via podcast. You can find us on iTunes under College Radio. You can find us on Barbara's website, penonfire.com. You can get direct downloads of past shows. You can find out who's coming up. There's information on our fantastic speaker series up there. It is all there, a one-stop shop. I'm your host, Marie Stone. This is Writers on Writing. We are dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, Barbara and I are here with authors, poets, literary agents, giving you the latest and most up-to-date information on the publishing world. I'm incredibly pleased to be joined now by Amanda Copland. Coming up in the second half of the show, Edie Maldove will be here talking about her novel, Lola, California. Amanda was born in Wenatchee, Washington. She received her BA from the University of Oregon and MFA from the University of Minnesota. A recipient of residencies of the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, Massachusetts, and the Omni International Arts Center in Liddig House in Ghent, New York. She lives in Portland, Oregon. The book is The Orchidist. It's published by Harper, and it's the subject of our discussion this morning. Amanda, welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thanks thanks for doing this. Talk about a debut novel. It's getting a lot of, I know it's getting a lot of press. It is just gorgeous. So you're going to introduce it way better than I'm going to introduce it, so I'm going to let you do that. talk about the novel and what inspired it for you.
Well, the novel is about a man, an orchardist, who has lived alone for most of his life. And then near the end of his life, he encounters two young pregnant girls. And the novel is sort of about, you know, what happens after they meet and about their lives. And the book was inspired by, really in a general way, by my own sort of love of that particular landscape, the orchards in North Central Washington. I grew up, I spent a lot of time in my grandparents' orchards just outside of Wenatchee. And so the book is, you know, about that landscape, and it's also about these, you know, particular characters, you know, some of whom were sort of modeled on people in my own life, you know, sort of very loosely. The main orchardist being based upon my grandfather, who I was really close to growing up.
Yeah. So I grew up in Walla Walla, Washington. Nobody
knows
that.
No, my mom was born in Prosser, which is, if
so
you know where
fun.
That's at,
I
the,
do.
Outside of Kennewick.
I do. You know, I've always thought, because, you know, my brain goes back to that place as well, and I've always wondered if it's, you know, particular to that landscape, or if mm-hmm. it's particular to childhood memories, and wherever you grew up is kind of fertile ground for where your center of gravity sort of lies. But I totally agree with you. The eastern side of the Pacific Northwest, the eastern side of Washington, it, for some other reason, you know, it's totally under my skin as well. Mm. So it was sort of fun to return home to this. And the
oh, great.
We had more onions than apples, but
of course.
So how long had this book been percolating in you? Do you feel like this was a story that had been coming for kind of decades and you finally let it out? Or do you feel like something like an image or a character kind of came to you and you just sat down and started writing? Tell me a little bit about the germ of and the seeds of this.
Well, I think it was actually both of those things. I think, you know, ever since I was a child and I spent a lot of time in that landscape, you know, I was deeply affected by it. And I think, you know, maybe it's too grand of a thing to say, but I think even, you know, when I was that young, I knew that I would write about that place someday. And it was very, you know, I was surrounded by the trees and the beauty of the place, but also I was, there was a lot of sort of hard things growing up. You know, my grandfather was very sick, and there was always this sort of looming possibility. He had heart problems, that he would, you know, have another heart attack. And so I think that sort of what made that, you know, my childhood in that particular landscape sort of injected it with this sort of almost, not gloom, but, you know, it's sort of, you know, I was always thinking about, you know, mortality, even at that young age. And so I think that's what sort of made, you know, those two things sort of had a relationship in my mind and my imagination, those two feelings. And then when I was in graduate school, I was wanting to write short stories. That's what I thought I wanted to do, you know, forever. I love that form. And then one day, you know, I just was visited by this sort of vision of this orchardist and these two girls, and, you know, I knew that I had to do something about this, you know, and I tried to write a short story about them, and it didn't work, and I knew that, you know, they had to be written about in a different way, and so I thought about writing a novel, and I just went from there.
Wow. And did you write it fairly linearly, you know, kind of, I mean, the story is somewhat of a linear storyline. There's obviously a lot of flashbacks, mm-hmm. but is that how it came out of you, or was it a lot of back and forth?
It was a lot of back and forth and a lot of drafts. So, you know, once I had accumulated, you know, several drafts or parts of drafts, you know, that I had abandoned, I sort of, you know, started stitching things together. So the book to me, when I look at it now, is like a crazy quilt of, you know, drafts that I had sort of left at a certain time, but really liked, you know, parts of them. I would carry them over into the next draft. And at one point, near the very end of the process, I was corresponding with my agent, Bill Clegg, who besides being a wonderful agent, is an amazing editor and reader. He has a brilliant mind for literature. And he said, you know, very gently, well, why don't you put everything that's, you know, out of chronological order, why don't you put it in chronological order and just see what happens? And, you know, I threw my own very private writerly fit, you know, thinking, well, you know, I wanted to put things out of chronological order to do some sort of trick, you know, and I thought I was being clever, but I did what he said just to see what happened, and things really opened up. The manuscript just sort of settled within itself, and it was a fairly easy thing to do. There was very little cleanup after that change, and the book is just so much the better for it.
I love good readers. They're so useful sometimes.
Yes. Oh,
especially when they're right.
Writer's best friend or good readers who will read their work.
Exactly. My guest this morning is Amanda Copeland. I want to make sure I'm pronouncing your last name right, because I always ask before the interview, and I didn't do that today for some reason. Is it Copeland or Copland?
It's Copeland.
Excellent. And the book is The Orchardist. So I don't want to give too much away about the novel, but I will say there are some very dark, difficult subject matter. I don't think it's too much to say that there's a brothel populated by very young girls, mm-hmm. and, you know, the things that go on there. So talk to me about living in dark places for extended periods of time. I know, you know, it's one thing for a reader. It's a very different thing for a writer to stay in that suspended place of dark for periods of time. What was that experience like for you?
Well, I mean, I think the most difficult person to write about in terms of, you know, what you just described was the character of Della, who we follow, you know, through the entire book. And, you know, it was very difficult to write about her, but it was also, it was just a very rich experience because, you know, I looked at her and I looked at what had happened to her, and, you know, there was so much, you know, the soil and sort of talking about her was so rich and so, you know, complicated that I, as a writer, it was just really exciting. You know, I hate to say that it was exciting to write about someone with a past like that, and, you know, I don't mean to put it that way, but in terms of a writer and examining someone's psychology, you know, I could really engage with that, and it was really, really interesting, you know, to me to be with her and to write about how she behaved. You know, there's a certain point that comes where, you know, all writers will say this, when, you know, you've written a character and the character sort of, you know, just sort of becomes himself or herself, and you just sort of watch what they do. You know them so well that you just sort of observe their behavior and then sort of try to understand where that comes from. They become like a, you know, like a person, which is a great experience as a writer. But she's just, you know, she intrigues me. She's such an awful sort of sad character, you know. It's amazing that, you know, that she exists in the book. I still look at that character and think, you know, where did that come from, sort of thing.
I made her. Yeah, it's
right.
Yeah, authors' relationships with characters, I think, and you know how they impact their lives and how they kind of go on to live in their heads and all of that, and where they come from, I think, is so fascinating. I've talked to therapists about whether or not they have to like their patients, and I guess the corollary of this is how much you have to like your characters. You know, I imagine you have to have empathy for them and understand their motives in order to treat them fairly. But were there characters in here that kind of pushed your own limits in terms of how much you could handle from them?
Well, yeah, Della, definitely. Yeah. I mean, you know, I said I enjoyed writing about her, but she's someone who would be the worst sort of companion
right.
in real life. You know, I mean,
right.
she's non-communicative. She can be cruel without even batting an eyelid. You know, to her, it doesn't, you know, if it doesn't affect her or anything she cares about, then she just really can't care about it. And, you know, so she's really not a likable character, but, yeah, I mean, I feel like, you know, in terms of the other characters in the book, everyone else compared to her is extremely likable.
Right.
You know, Talmadge, one of the main characters, is, you know, this really, there's nothing about him really to dislike unless, you know, you think that he's sort of makes himself too vulnerable to being hurt, you know, by the girls in the beginning or by Della, you know.
And Della, it seems like she was telling you what she was going to do. I mean, she seems like a very self-directed character that you were, I mean, you can tell me if this is true or not, but that you were kind of holding, you know, the reins, but she was the horse taking you on the journey, and you just were going to go where she wanted you to go.
Yes, definitely. That's true.
Yeah. The book is The Orchardist, is what we're talking about this morning. You know, it'd be fun if you could read to us. Can you take a few minutes out to read from the book?
Sure. So in this scene, this is near the beginning of the book, and the two girls, Jane and Della, have entered Talmadge's orchard, and they're just sort of skulking around. And so this is when they're in the orchard. They climbed up into the tree until the wood became soft under their palms and feet. From here, they could watch whatever was happening below in the field. And if they climbed higher into the tree, which they had done, they could locate the man wherever he was working. They were camouflaged, or they thought they were, and suspended, safe from danger, on the ground. There was a type of heat and light that was direct and overhead and bleached the orchard of color, the orchard at noon on the hottest days. And then there were mornings when the air was blue and soft, and the leaves of the trees looked like velvet. There were times when the girls knew where the man was in the orchard, and times they did not. These times they trod slowly and carefully, not that they thought he would harm them, not really, but it had become a kind of game. You might turn the corner into an orchard row and find him there, walking toward you or away, or maybe you saw his legs, his trunk, obscured in leaves. Della, distracted for a moment in the heat of the day, the sun hung high and sweat trickled down the back of her skull, turned the corner and almost ran into him. She stepped back and held very still, did not look up at him, said lightly before she stepped around him, "Afternoon." He had become for them not a threat, though he was not devoid of threat. Why had he taken them in? Why did he stand for them to roam the place without demanding anything from them? And his threat entertained them more than the fact that they were curious about him. They were not interested at that point in the history or emotional life of men they encountered. This was not a rule they had set up for themselves, but rather a consequence of their experience. It was only important to know, to sense, but also to recall, if the man before them would fly into a rage, would lunge at them, was capable of swift and unremitting violence. And yet Della found herself those hot days roaming the avenues, struck by a sharp and intermittent desire to see this new man's, this orchardist's face. She was dissatisfied with seeing the front of his overall pockets, his denim legs and trees, his large burnished hands hanging at his sides. Through glances, she had caught various features, his nose, the set of his shoulders, the striking color of his eyes. But he had one of those complicated faces that one had to consider at length to understand how emotion lay on it, to understand it at all. It was like a landscape, that wide and complicated, many-layered expanse. She wanted to study his face because it was different in an important way, but she did not know exactly how.
That's amazing. The book is The Orchardist. My guest this morning is Amanda Copeland. You have such, I'm fairly unique in commenting on this, but you have such an incredibly mature, beautiful, singular, strong voice. I know you've been compared to Marilyn Robinson. Parts of this reminded me a little of Cormac McCarthy, the sparseness of the landscape, you know, the sparseness of your prose, the powerful word choices. Is voice something that you've had to work on and cultivate? Does this part of it just come very naturally to you, and it's the characters and plot line that, you know, give you more issues than the voice? Or talk a little bit about, if you can, about finding the voice for this.
Well, I think that's the hardest thing as a writer, one of the hardest things anyways, is to find your own particular voice. And, you know, especially being, you know, a young writer, like when I started graduate school, you know, and I knew that one of the, you know, most important things was to have a unique voice. But, you know, when you're just starting out and really seriously engaging with writing, you know, it's really hard to know what that means. Or to even be mature or developed enough as a writer, you know, you just aren't at that point to know what your voice is. So, you know, I read a lot of people, you know, Cormac McCarthy among them, you know, Faulkner, Toni Morrison, Virginia Woolf are some of my favorite writers, and I just studied them, and I mimicked their voice, their voices for a long time until I sort of figured out, you know, what mine sounded like, and then I sort of started in another direction. But you can, I mean, definitely, you know, when I read this book, I look at passages and I think, well, I know what I was reading when I wrote this, or, you know, I know who I sort of went to for help. Yeah. You know, I looked at this chapter in Toni Morrison, you know, to sort of see how she handled, like, the detached voice or something like that. For this passage. I mean, you know, I talked about this book being a crazy quilt, you know, looking at different drafts and stitching them together, but also, you know, I hear sort of different voices of the writers I tried to emulate, you know, in the beginning. And I don't necessarily know if that's something I'm going to do in other books, you know, now that, I mean, this is the first book, so, you know, I feel like those other voices are going to be probably more present in here than any other thing I write, but, I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. You know, maybe other voices will come in. I'll become obsessed with other writers, and those will be present in future books. I don't know.
I know. I found myself as I was reading this, dying to read, you know, anything else you had written, even an email or something.
Oh,
you know?
Funny.
Because I was thinking, I wonder if this carries through. If anything I pick up of Amanda's, you know, is just going to scream this voice because. Yeah, it is. It's just gorgeous. Incredibly mature. I should tell people, you're 31 years old, and, you know, you just sound like you have the wisdom of, I don't know, 150-year-old or something. It's really...
oh, dear.
It's really great. So let's talk a little bit about the revision process, and you're working with the editor and him telling you to, you know, put everything chronologically. That sounds like, you know, one piece of great advice. But tell me a little bit about, so you have all of these drafts sitting in front of you. It's a big novel, you know, it's 400-plus pages. And kind of finding your way through the through the orchard of trees, so to speak, trying to, you know, put this together in the right order. Because I imagine once you're reading draft after draft, you're sort of getting lost in you know, did I say this here, and where does that go? So tell me a little bit about how you parsed this out and handled the revision.
Well, I remember in the very beginning, you know, thinking about writing a novel, I wrote this opening chapter, and it looks, you know, a lot like the opening chapter we see in the final book. You can recognize it at least. And I had written this opening chapter and shared it with people, you know, my colleagues in graduate school and my teachers. And so it was talked about a lot, you know, amongst ourselves, and I sort of polished that opening chapter until I was really proud of it. But, you know, and that was, you know, on one hand, it gave me sort of confidence, and it was sort of a springboard, you know, to sort of launch me into the rest of the novel. But on the other hand, you know, I sort of didn't know where to go after this opening chapter. You know, I'd set everything up, but I just felt really insecure about engaging with what came next. And, you know, one of the things about writing a novel is that, you know, for me at least, you have to sort of submit to utter messiness and disorganization, and you sort of have to plunge into this chaos before you can sit back and sort of look at everything you have and try to organize it. And for some people, you know, and there's a part of myself that loves that, but another part of me that's just thinking, oh my God, it's going to take so much time, it's going to exhaust me, I'm going to be so exasperated and frustrated. You know, in the end, though, you just have to submit to all of it. And, you know, just sort of, if you have an idea, you get struck by, you know, a certain way of writing or a certain chapter that seems really weird and it's not going to fit in, you just have to follow that,
yeah,
that instinct. You know, and if it succeeds, wonderful, it's probably going to fail. But you sort of keep it around just in case. And you just have to sort of go where your gut tells you. And if it takes you 8 years like it did me, then that's how long it's going to take. And for a lot of people, it's just too frustrating and they give up, which is totally understandable. You know, there's a lot of really wonderful things in the world to do besides writing, you know. But you know, for some people, writing is just, you know, so rewarding, even if you don't get recognized for, you know, the good work you do. You know, it just sort of appeals to that part of your brain that loves to, you know, do puzzles and,
right,
and sort of figure out large projects.
Were there big, sort of, because you talked about, you know, the main character is based on your grandfather, and that loss when you were smaller, when you were young, really kind of informing that character that the novel probably couldn't have been written without enduring that loss of him.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if there were big questions that you set out to answer for yourself in this novel that these characters were intended to work out for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, the novel sort of stands on its own as having, you know, its own life, and it's about these particular characters who, you know, are very, to me, they became super vivid, and they became, you know, real people to me, you know, who I was watching. So that's sort of an achievement on its own, and I really appreciate that. On the other hand, you know, I read the book, I look at it now, and I see it's sort of I've talked about this before, it's a container for everything I'd been thinking about, like, as a child and as a young adult. You know, I sort of put my questions in this book, and I don't know if I answered them, but it's really not important to me somehow to have certain questions or emotional questions or spiritual questions answered. It was enough for me to sort of organize the question in this way and put them in the book. And I did that somehow. You know, you can't really point to particular questions in the book, but the whole book is sort of a question. You know, that I sort of drew with the characters and with the structure and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, the big question, I think, you know, that's everybody's big question, and, you know, is every sort of writer's big question is, you know, just thinking about life and death, you know, speaking of grand topics. But I really think, you know, that that's what I was trying to question. I mean, these people in the book, you know, suffer enormously. And but they all, you know, there's also moments of real beauty and comfort. And I think, you know, it's just sort of holding those two things in your mind and thinking, well, this is what life is, you know, and sort of trying to come to terms with that. You know, why can't we just be happy and comfortable and have people love us? Why is there this sort of unexplainable pain always, you know, especially in the character of Della? You know, she just cannot be happy. And what do we do with people like that in our lives? Those were sort of my big questions.
Yeah, I always wonder if people work out life through fiction or they work out their fiction through life experience and then go write about it, you know, and it sounds like you've done both, you know, really.
Right. I mean,
it's some of the other, that life is feeding the fiction and the fiction is sort of informing the life and how you choose to look at it and live it. Were there big demons that sort of came for you in this? I know first novels are, you know, every novel is wrought with anxiety, let's be honest. But I was wondering if there, you know, over the course of the 8 years, if sort of big demons, story demons, writing demons, otherwise, kind of came for you that started to derail this and how you pulled yourself back onto the track.
Well, I think, you know, I experienced what just a lot of, you know, artists experience, you know, over the course of their lives, just moments of, you know, you commit to a project and, you know, sometimes it just feels like you're going crazy. I mean, literally going crazy, you know. You have friends who have, you know, sort of responsible jobs and who are, you know, making a living for themselves, and you're sort of, you know, eking by and, you know, working on this project that, you know, may or may not be recognized by the larger community, and you may or may not receive any financial compensation for it. You know, as a sort of person, you know, writing in their 20s, seeing sort of other people make other choices for themselves in terms of how they're going to live their lives. You know, it seems like a romantic thing when you're growing up to be, you know, a struggling artist, but it's just that. It's just you're struggling all the time, and sometimes you don't know, you know, what the future holds. And that's, you know, those demons sort of visited me, you know, when I was writing, saying that, you know, this is a waste of time, or, you know, what are you doing?
Thank God you won.
Yeah. Well, you know, because there's a part of me, and I think, you know, for you know, any artist, you have to have a certain level of stubbornness, you know, which some people see as, you know, just stubbornness and hard-headedness and not accepting that you should do something else. But, you know, if there weren't stubborn artists, you know, who knows what our landscape, our cultural landscape would look like. So
isn't that true?
It's put into us for a reason.
Isn't that true? Yeah, isn't that true? Sadly, we've drawn down on our time. Any advice coming through this, coming through the canal of writing a first novel that you want to share with writers? You've shared
a
lot, so
yeah. I mean, I would say, just, you know, speaking of stubbornness, I mean, if you want to write something, and if you're visited by a vision, and you're working on your novel, you know, just believe in yourself and follow your instincts, and you know that the best reward is just good work. So that's it.
That's it. That's beautiful, Amanda. This novel is gorgeous. I mean,
thank you so much.
Have to say,
I appreciate that.
The prose of this is just gorgeous, and it was a huge pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
That was Amanda Copland. The book is The Orchardist and Orchardist. I keep looking at it and saying, there's no orchids in it. I don't know. but there's a lot of apple trees. The Orchardist does not slip off my tongue so easily. It is published by Harper. It is, like I say, it's a very, very strong voice. We're going to take a short break, but please stay with me. Edie Maldove is going to be here in the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We will be right back.
come back, baby. Please don't go. No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. We gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month better than a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
Opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. To find out more about this talk show or other talk shows broadcasting on KUCI, log on to our website at kuci.org or check out the latest program guide.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. Again, you can visit iTunes. We're under College Radio. You can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series, events, and more. We've taken the month of August off on the speaker series, but we're coming back in September. Susan Strait will be here. Other great authors are coming up this fall, so be sure and check us out on Barbara's website. Get your tickets early. These events do typically sell out fairly frequently and early, so make sure you get your tickets for that. I'm your host, Marie Stone, and I'm joined now by Edie Maydev. Edie grew up in Berkeley, California, and attended Yale University for her undergraduate degree and Mills College for grad school. She worked briefly as a story analyst in Los Angeles, lived in Sri Lanka for 2 years on a Fulbright scholarship, and completed her novel Crawl Space while working out of a storage shed in Mendocino, California. I love that. She received the Bard Fiction Prize for Writers Under 40 in 2005 and a Lannan Literary Fellowship in 2007. Her previous works include Crawl Space and The Far Field, but it is her latest novel, Lola, California, published by Picador, that we will chat about in part this morning. Edie, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Marie.
Thanks for coming on. So I'm going to let you talk about the novel, introduce it, tell us a little bit about the structure of it, the storyline, and what inspired it.
Okay, great. Well, first of all, it is probably geared to nothing greater than whatever your listeners are come from. I mean, in other words, the novel was geared for people in your geographic region, and
yes,
of right, probably the people like those who might have some affiliation with the University of Irvine. But yeah, anyway, that said, so I was struck. We are living in a strange age where there's this explosion in social communication, you know, Facebook and all that, probably unprecedented in history. And at the same time, you know, we have such a kind of dearth of the kind of real-life community-making, friendship-making possibility that used to abound. And I was struck by the fact that, or what seemed to be me to be the case, that many people have all their future adult possibilities formed by whatever important friend they have between, let's say, these crucible important ages of, let's say, 14 to 22.
Mm-hmm.
So the person, I would venture to say that you, maybe, or anyone who's listening to your show, might find it true that those people with whom they consorted in those years kind of held in amber all the possibilities of who they would become.
Mm-hmm.
And if we think in some way of ourselves on our deathbeds, it is probably true that as much as we would have perhaps an array of romantic companions and, you know, children and so on, those friends who form who we become are so crucial. So, and I was struck also by this lack in contemporary novels. You know, there are not many, many novels, I can count them on one hand, that really deal with this primacy of friendship, especially female friendship. And so, okay, so take that as a premise. It's the romance of friendship between girls in that age. So the plot of the novel is that two friends who found this kind of criminal freedom together as young girls re-meet in midlife. And the father of one of them is a cult figure. He's on death row for having murdered the mother of one of them, but is also a strange philosopher, charismatic guru type of the kind only California, or California, is especially good at producing. I would also venture to say that perhaps you or your listeners have met that kind of charismatic Californian man who is capable of using ideas and appeal to kind of graft his own narcissism into the lives of those he touches.
Mm-hmm.
So this guy is on death row. The two girls meet as women in midlife in a California health spa located somewhere along Highway 5. And how they remember or don't fail to remember their friendship alters the fate of the father, whose execution is in 10 days or destined to be in 10 days.
Right.
So that's the basic plot. But, you know, it touches on this kind of post-countercultural buzzkill, the dreams and hopes of California. You know, there's a whole section in which one of the main characters, Lana, is lost in Los Angeles and trying to find meaning, you know, among the shore of all these possibilities, you know, people who come to California to dream or who grow up here dreaming and find the dream is not quite what they believed it to be.
Right, right. We were talking about this in the first half hour. The question that I've asked of therapists about their patients and whether it's necessary, how much you have to like the people that you're working with. And I was wondering this about your characters and how much you certainly have to have empathy for them. You have to understand where they're coming from. How much affinity did you have for these people in terms of, you know, how much time you wanted to spend with them?
Oh, you know, it's a wonderful question. So I think as a writer, you know, in going about creating character, you are doing one of two things. You're either kind of using fission, in which you're splintering parts of yourself off and exaggerating those shards, or fusion, where you're kind of bringing together kind of a composite of people you've known. And, you know, say with my second novel, which was Crawl Space, which was told from the voice of a former Nazi, I wanted to explore the mind of evil in that book and really kind of inhabit, see what that was. And in this book, I wanted to, you know, similarly, there, these characters range the spectrum in terms of their likability.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it's interesting for me to have the reader go on a process, you know, of coming to identify with qualities he or she might find challenging in others, so that the reading the novel itself leads you on a moral inquiry.
Right, right. Yeah, I was struck by these are just wonderful characters. I was wondering if you ever get, somebody had given you the comment that Vic is a sort of distant cousin of Emil in the Crawl Space, and you felt like you were breaking new ground with Vic. But I was wondering if you had a feeling that, separate and apart from whatever, you know, parallels there are with both of these men being in prison and whatnot, if the books were somehow otherwise in dialogue with each other, if your areas of concern as a writer are in dialogue with each other and sort of carry on, and how your novels, looking across the body of these three novels, kind of fit together, you know, to come be born out of the same person.
Yeah, no, it's a wonderful question. Again, you know, I think as people, we travel through the world kind of holding placards of maybe three basic values we care about. I mean, I think this starts to solidify for many people around, you know, maybe in their 20s, you know,
yeah,
perhaps. But at any rate, so, you know, when I think of these three novels so far, and I'm working on a fourth that's set in Cuba, what I notice is that I'm very interested in history as a process. So sort of how, you know, the stories we tell about ourselves have a kind of elasticity, and also how the choices we make, well, you know, that there's a parallel world in which all the choices we've not made continue to live, and that a lot of the ways we tend to create meaning has to do with how we consider where we are now and who we once were, who we once dreamed of being. And I find that just incredibly rich, productive terrain. You know, the writers I love, you know, let's say, you know, Faulkner, Conrad, Tolstoy, the people I've loved or who have really touched me, but what I really think of somehow is Madame Bovary, where she has, you know, she's in some world of questioning about her own relation to sin. They touch me because the character is creating meaning between the choices made and the choices unmade, and remembering them alters his or her understanding of those choices.
Right, right. Yeah, this notion that those ages between 14 and 22 are such fertile ground, and who you meet in those times are impact who you become, I think, is so interesting. And we were talking in the first half hour about the importance of place where you grow up, also holding that same fertile territory in your head that writers so often in their minds go back to those formative years, those places where they spent their childhoods. And I was wondering, because sense of place is so critical in all of your novels, it sounds like the one that's forthcoming is no exception to that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about placing a novel and, you know, where you have spent some of your years and how place has germinated in your head to, you know, to manifest itself in these books.
Yeah. You know, I have been really interested in, you know, right now I'm sort of in exile from California, my beloved California, and I'm living in New York. And every time I revisit California, it's like a mnemonic bomb. I mean, just memory goes off in an unbelievable way. And I remember once reading that Philip Roth would revisit, you know, the streets of Newark to try to regenerate that childhood, you know, the priest eating the Madeleine, explosion of memory that you have walking in a place where you know, your cells are no longer the same cells, and yet you have such a, again, rich sense of the meaning that that place inspired for you. So, you know, it's not as if with most of my work, I haven't exactly said, okay, now I'm going to write a novel about a Westerner who goes out and imposes his vision of Buddhism on these Ceylonese in Sri Lanka, or, you know, now I'm going to write a novel about dystopian California. I like to start with kind of a central emotional problem, you know, one that matters to me. Usually it's sort of a character or an image that will begin the book. You know, then the place grows out of it. And I do love to travel. And I find that travel is a way of jarring myself from my own assumptions.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, in some way, the books probably represent as much a document of my autobiography as they seem to be formed from the ground up, from the place that inspires them.
My guest this morning is Edie Maydev. The book is Lola, California. I have to ask about, I know in other interviews you've given, you've talked a lot about the importance of music and the importance of music in your life, and you made the comment that all novelists really want to be musicians, or at least wanted to be musicians at some point in their life. And I'd love to hear your thoughts about music and how it relates to writing and how it's related to your own writing.
You know, thank you. You somehow, if I were a ball player, I would feel as if you were pitching me the most delicious balls with these questions. Okay, so I guess my feeling about it is that language does aspire to the condition of music. You have music which is not a debased currency. You know, we don't sing notes, wordless notes to each other to convey our feeling. And language is kind of banal thing we use every day to say, can you put more milk in my coffee, or, you know, the music has this purity. So, but nonetheless, I really think as a writer of fiction, I have the possibility of affecting your mind as a reader by the use of particular sounds or cadences. And I believe in constructing a novel along a kind of symphonic mentality. I came to writing after having played the piano for some years and sort of, you know, sort of having fancied that I might become a composer. And I feel the principles are very similar. You know, there's a beautiful book I love by Milan Kundera called The Art of the Novel, where he talks about really thoughtfully creating a novel using specific themes. I'm not that formulaic, but I do, you know, your novel can swell to robust symphonic energies and then can dwindle to a thin and attenuated coda. And I think this is how we can have that possibility for the reader of, you know, having the kind of catharsis that I still think the novel is the best technology for. In other words, I still feel the novel is our last best technology for penetrating the mystery of being human. And I think if you compose thinking as a musician in writing with words, there's a possibility of changing someone's mind or having them see the world, you know, just that much more freshly.
It's funny you should say that, because I was just thinking this morning about making, having you, and you're the perfect person to do it, make the case for fiction, because we seem saturated in this, you know, there's been sort of a takeoff of the memoir, and I'm certainly not disparaging the memoir, it's a great form. But, you know, the proliferation of reality TV, which I totally don't understand. But anyway, I think it's an important time to make a case for fiction, that fiction can tell more truths, perhaps, than, you know, adherence to the biography of somebody's life. And I'd love to get your thoughts on that, on this, you know, at this particular time period where our publishing industry seems to now be, where the state of fiction seems to now be, to give you an opportunity to make a case for fiction, which I guess you already have done, but I'd love...
No, definitely. No, it's a subject I feel really passionate about. You know, if I were to have sat down and said, okay, I'm going to write this novel about California, and I'm going to just write from my own subjectivity, it would have been such a limited piece of work. I, you know, there's beautiful nonfiction that exists in the world. I think of, you know, some of the people I love, Richard Kapuscinski, or At a certain point in time, I really loved Bruce Chatwin's song line. So many other works that I, you know, Michael Ondaatje's Running in the Family. But when you stake a truth claim and say, I am going to write nonfiction, you're stating that your view of the world is kind of a fixed tether to that bit that you're going to describe. Whereas when you say, I'm going to write fiction, suddenly your one chance as an author to live many, many lifetimes in your one limited little life is so expanded. So it becomes a greater empathic exercise. So both the reader, one hopes, has this experience of their own empathy expanded. And, you know, you too, as a writer, get to live all the different subjectivities that your one subjectivity doesn't let you live otherwise. So, you know, for me, fiction is a place that people can wander and get lost in and have their experience of the world expanded, whereas with nonfiction, it's very important for us to learn the facts that we need to know to continue on in the world. But at the same time, it's useful for us to remember to question. I think that's something I'm evangelical about.
Do you feel like you work out your life through fiction, or do you feel like fiction helps you to work out questions in your life, or both?
I think I work out questions in my life through fiction. I think, you know, for example, with the second novel, Crawl Space, I said to myself, you know, what is a strange compulsion? You know, Freud calls it the right, the eternal return. You know, the strange compulsion I have to always return to the scene of a crime if I feel guilty about something. And that sort of grew into this, you know, Nazi. With Lola, California, I said to myself, why is it that I now, as a mother with two small children, you know, a working mom and a writer, you know, often find my mind returning to that moment when I had that criminal freedom with, you know, X or Y female friend back in high school? And what happened to that friendship when the kind of precocious sexualization of our society started to come in? And also, how did that sense of endless choice, how did that play out against the strange choicelessness of California, its policy on the, you know, its death penalty policy, the kind of general sort of sense of belatedness a lot of us growing up after the 60s or 70s might have felt, you know, how did that youth play out against that lack of choice?
Over the, we're drawing down on our time, sadly, because I have a thousand other questions. But anyway, so such is the way of my life. But I'm wondering if over the course of the novels, if they're getting easier now that you're into book four, is there sort of a, you know, I know with first novelists, and we were talking about this in the first half hour, there's this sense of, you know, am I wasting my life? Is this thing ever going to go anywhere? And I'm wondering if having gone through the process three, now four times, if that part of you calms down, if certain things get easier, if certain things get more difficult, you know, I suppose at some point some writers have talked about, you know, I gave everything I had to this novel, and what else do I have to say? So maybe that's a way it gets more difficult. But I'm wondering now that you're getting yourself into four novels in, what's getting easier and what's getting harder?
Oh, yes. I have a lot to say on this. In fact, this summer I wrote we were just talking about nonfiction, but I wrote a creativity manual for those who want to write or do other art. It's in its nascent stages, so I have a lot of thoughts on this. But, I'd like to say to you creative types out there that it gets easier, but I think each time, each novel demands its own language and its own way of thinking, and one can really feel one's on some choppy seas in the beginning of any project. And so I always counsel people to navigate by the light of the moon and, you know, not necessarily on the land, the fixed place you thought you were going to go. And so a lot of the thing I've learned is the act of being patient with oneself as the seas get choppy and trusting that perhaps the land you end up on is not exactly what you had hoped to get to. I do put out little, for whatever this is worth, I'll just share this, little creativity tips on Twitter at Lola California, if anyone happens to do that. And I sometimes do the same thing on on Facebook in the Lola, California group there.
Well, I will be a new friend.
That's good. Fantastic. Be my friend. Right, here we're talking. Now we're doing full circle because, I mean, on the one hand, I don't like this explosion of social. On the other hand, I see that it's been very useful, and I like to feel that I'm helping people in this world.
Can't ignore it. It is what it is. It is here, so you can't. Yeah, right. Ignoring it is to your detriment. That's for sure.
Right.
Edie Madev, I wish we had another hour, but this was a huge pleasure. I will take whatever I can get from you. This was fantastic. Thank you so much.
Oh, thanks, Marie, and likewise.
That was Edie Madev. The book is Lola, California. It is published by Picador, and it is out and available. You can follow Edie, apparently, on Twitter and Facebook, which I'm going to go do right now. That, unfortunately, is all the time we have for today. Barbara will be right back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next time, thanks so much for joining me. Have a great day.
I just don't wanna be free, no.